Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotting in Washington.
It's a purely civil matter. Some transaction that happened between the former first lady and some of her relatives or relatives of the husband. This is an abuse of the police.
Zambia Socialist Party condemns the police for trying to break down the main gate at the residence of former President Edgar Lungu.
The elected officials that attended, they clearly showed that I still maintain the support and the confidence of the members of my party.
The biggest opposition Botswana Patriotic Front chooses Biggie Butali as the presidential candidate.
Some countries on the continent, they actually depend on these tariffs and customs duties as the bulk of their revenues. So it's going to be a real challenge.
And the head of the International Monetary Fund urges African countries to implement the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Zambia, the Socialist Party has condemned the police for trying to break down the gate at the residence of former President Edgar Chagwa Lungu. They surrounded his home to search for evidence of alleged corruption, but local media reports say the police were also investigating a dispute between an individual and the former First Lady. Frank Bwali, a spokesman for the Socialist Party and a former High Commissioner to Australia, condemned the police action. He tells me that state institutions, including the police and the courts, should not be used to intimidate and harass opponents.
Yes, we think that this is a senseless move to send police heavily armed in riot gear, using armored vehicles to go and try to break into the residence of the former president, over an issue that would make our country a laughingstock if the people came to actually know what the matter is about. It's a purely civil matter. Some transaction that happened between the former first lady and some of her relatives or relatives of the husband. This is an abuse of the police, the kind of abuse that we have seen before in this country, which unfortunately, and to the disappointment of many Zambians, is being repeated by President Hakainde Hichilema, contrary to what he promised to do upon being elected Republican president.
But Frank, the government cannot be blamed for this. Shouldn't the blame go to the police taking action that your party described as unnecessarily dramatic?
This country has implemented a statutory instrument, 1123, last year, which has placed the police, the Drug Enforcement Commission, the Anti-Corruption Commission, and other law enforcement agencies directly under President Hakainde Hichilema, under State House. But that is not the only reason why we are pointing fingers at President Hakainde Hichilema. There is a culture in this country where the police have never, and until the status changes, will never act on politically exposed individuals without consultation or indeed being directly asked to move on such an individual.
But Frank, people are suggesting that they expect you to say that because former President Edgar Lungu was your former boss. He appointed you as the High Commissioner to Australia. So they expect you to come out swinging in his favor. How do you respond to that?
I am not giving a personal position. I am giving the position of the Socialist Party. The initial statement on this matter was not issued by me. It was issued by our leader, Comrade Dr. Fred Mem. And in that statement is very categorical that we saw this under President Edgar Chagwa Lungu. We condemned it, and we are condemning it under this government. So there's nothing like the Socialist Party defending President Edgar Chagwa Lungu. There's nothing like that. And I have issued a statement today, which I'll make available to you, where I have made it very clear as spokesperson of the Socialist Party that previous abuse of the police will not make the Zambian people ignore the abuse of the police today by President Hakainde Hichilema. Because there is this notion among UPND members, when their president does something wrong, their response is that this was done by the previous government. As if to say, the wrongs that the previous government did were actually a way of baptizing those actions in readiness for Mr. Hakainde Hichilema to do the same things which today should be considered as not a wrong thing.
What do you think should have been the best way to handle this issue? Because the issue still is under investigation by the Zambian police. What do you think is the best way forward, or what does your party think is the best way forward to handle this?
The best way to handle this issue is what the police have done today. The police summoned the former first lady to Hoodlands police station, not very far from where they live, where the former first family lived, and she obliged. She went and gave a statement. And if this matter is civil, as we have all come to understand, even that summoning of the first lady, the former first lady, is wrong. That matter, the complainant should have gone to court to seek relief in this purely civil matter. It's not a criminal matter. The mere fact that President Lungu's wife is involved does not make it a criminal matter.
Frank Bwalya is the spokesman for the Zambia Socialist Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. The main opposition Botswana Patriotic Front, or BPF, has chosen its leader, Biggie Butali, as its presidential candidate in the 2024 elections. The resolution was made at a meeting of the BPF last week in the capital, Habaroni. But analysts say recent infighting for the leadership of the party could derail its electoral prospects. Tensions rose after Butali filed a petition in court seeking to be declared the legitimate leader of the party. He cited individuals including former President Serete Kama Ian Kama of trying to create chaos and instability in the BPF, accusations the former president sharply denies. For more about the party's efforts to wrestle power from incumbent President Mokgweetsi Masisi in the upcoming vote, I reach Biggie Butali.
Well, the major outcome of the Congress was that we agreed to affiliate to the Umbrella for Democratic Change, which is an umbrella body of Botswana opposition parties going into the 2024 elections. And secondly, the party resolved that I be the flag bearer and presidential candidate for the party going into the 2024 elections. Those are the two major resolutions that came from the Congress.
How sure are you that this time around, the Umbrella Group will pose a significant threat or perhaps even win in next year's election? Because you have the incumbent President Masisi with the government machinery, with the power of incumbency and all the advantages that he has.
Two main issues. One being that we've had 13 by-elections since the last general elections, and we have won 11 of those, and the ruling party has won two. We had one just 2 days ago, a council by-election, and for the first time, the ruling party came third. They've always either won it or came second, but they came third. And they've been coming third in two or three other by-elections. Secondly, the COVID pandemic hit Botswana very hard because, as you know, Botswana depends on diamonds and tourism. Now, for the past 2 years, literally, we have no tourists coming into the country because of, firstly, the lockdown, and then again, the world recession. So the people of Botswana, in my opinion, are totally fed up. The people of Botswana are in pain, and they see no light at the end of the tunnel. For those two reasons, I think that the ruling party is on its last legs.
Biggie, what do you say to those who are saying the challenges that you have just enumerated are not enough to undermine the dominance of the ruling party, which has ruled the country since independence, and that for the fact that your own party, the BPF, the Botswana Patriotic Front, is having its own internal political challenges, including a dispute and dysfunction in your party. How do you even unify to challenge the ruling party? Because your party is in court at the moment about the leadership of the party, correct?
Yes, we've just come from court, and the courts have declared that I am the legal and lawful president of the BPF, firstly. Secondly, we've just held our Congress, and the attendance and the vibe and the energy that was in the place just showed that the turbulence that we've been going through did very little to dent our enthusiasm and the support that we endure. Now, the ruling party has been ruling, we are going for 6 decades now. And people are saying that if we give them another 5 years to rule for 65 years, the rest of the continent will think that there's something wrong with Botswana. People are openly saying that.
You went to court because you said some people want to wrestle political power or try to dislodge you from being the leader of the Botswana Patriotic Front. How sure are you that you will regain the trust and support of these people you are fighting, for which the court has ruled that you are the legitimate leader of the party?
I believe that the Congress itself, because of the number of people who attended, the elected officials that attended, they clearly showed that I still maintain the support and the confidence of the members of my party. And my detractors have seen that. And wherever they are, they will take stock and do the needful. Not only that, they are aware that we're going to join the Umbrella for Democratic Change. And the Umbrella for Democratic Change has been winning, like I said, 11 of the past 13 by-elections that have been held in this country. And once we join the Umbrella for Democratic Change, I think then, it will be more or less game over for the ruling party. Anybody who will oppose this coalition will be just relegating themselves to the dustbin of political history.
Biggie Butale is the leader of the main opposition Botswana Patriotic Front, or BPF. He spoke with me from the capital, Habaroni. In Uganda, the Civic Response on Environment and Development, or CRED, a land rights group, says the commercial production of oil should not come at the cost of the respect for human rights in the East African country. Bashir Twesije, the executive director for CRED, says the government and the oil companies must ensure the land rights of citizens affected by the impact of oil production are fairly and adequately addressed. The government has announced plans to begin producing oil in 2025. Analysts say this will lead the way for exporting the fuel within 2 years to help diversify the country's economy. For more about the call on the government and oil companies to address the demands of landowners, I sat down with Bashir Twesije here in the VOA studios in Washington, D.C.
Right now, the country has set timelines for oil extraction. We expect the first commercial drilling in 2026. So the government and the oil companies are working around the clock to achieve this timeline. Unfortunately, the government does not want people to even talk about oil.
Why?
Because they think it derails the ambitions of achieving the first oil in 2026.
But don't you think it's legitimate?
Well, as Ugandans, we think that the oil should be extracted, but it should not be at the cost of human rights. It should not be at the cost of people's livelihoods. So there is need for a balance between the extraction, which is going to get revenues for the government, but it is also important that the livelihoods and the human rights of the people who are living just next to the oil facilities are respected. So it is important that you have that balance, but because of the push to have this resource extracted, then there is an imbalance.
But some people
and
are suggesting
that undermines the space.
Yeah, but some people are suggesting that those who will be affected in the areas where they reside, where they're going to extract the oil, could have other businesses, second, third-hand businesses, that would improve their living conditions. So why do you think it will be tragic or very bad for them?
This is a very expensive project. We're talking about billions of US dollars that are being invested. We have three key projects, two for oil extraction and one for transportation of this crude to the international market through Tanzania. So I don't understand when you say that billions of dollars are being invested, but the not enough investment is being made to these communities are not asking for too much.
What are they asking?
They're asking that if you're taking my land for oil activities, compensate me fairly. Let the money come on time so that I can relocate to another place and I'm able to continue with my livelihood without any disruption.
But as some governments will tell you in Africa, the money is short in supply. The government might not necessarily have the funds, you know, to pay for such things. So wouldn't they wait for the commercial production of the oil in order to have that resources, in order to compensate them adequately?
No, the law is very clear in my country that you will not take my land for whatever reason until I've been paid fair and adequate compensation. I think the most important thing is that communities are not saying that, no, don't take my land. I've not come across a single individual who is saying that, no, don't take my land. Communities are saying, it's fine, you can take my land, but first pay for my land. And where there is contestation on how much is to be paid, communities are saying, okay, if you say that I'm asking for too much, fine, give me alternative land. Purchase for me alternative land in an area that is close to my home that has the same conditions, farming conditions as the land that I've been using, and I'm very free to go to that other piece of land. But that has also not been achieved. So I think really, to be fair, we need a fair balance of interests. I think communities are really patriotic.
But how realistic are these demands by these residents who are being moved as a result of the extraction? How realistic are their demands?
Well, I work a lot with these communities, and we have documented their demands. And personally, I think they are really very realistic. We are talking about a person whose, say, 1 acre of land is being taken by the industry. 1 acre of land is about a football pitch, and the government is the oil companies and the government are offering 3.5 million. Now, 3.5 million Ugandan shillings is about less than $1,000.
Bashir Twesije is the executive director at the Civic Response on Environment and Developmental Credit. He spoke with me from here in Washington.
In Sudan, conflict and instability has taken a heavy toll on its people, particularly its women. Weeks of intense fighting have left many homeless, hungry, and traumatized. Yet, Sudan's recent history, where women have played an instrumental role in peace resolution. On this week's episode of Our Voices, we'll examine the long-term effects that such conflict has on its society, its women, and future generations. Join the conversations Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
The head of the International Monetary Fund is urging African countries to implement the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. Speaking in Nairobi, Kristalina Georgieva said intracontinental trade could grow by 53% if steps are taken to remove trade barriers and improve logistics and transportation. VOA's Africa correspondent Mariama Diallo reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
IMF IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva says there are lots of benefits to be gained from the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, or AFCFTA. But first, she says, reforms are needed to capture the full advantages, including what the IMF sees as the number one priority, reducing trade barriers such as tariffs.
If Africa decides to follow ASEAN's example and bring trade barriers from 6% down to 1%, that would be a major step.
She also wants to see countries use fewer non-trade barriers like quotas and embargoes, attempt to integrate into global supply chains and diversify their economies. Gozi Okonjo-Iweala, the head of the World Trade Organization, praised the agreement, but said that to make it work, it's imperative to reduce the cost of trading within and outside Africa.
Trading with the outside are cost equivalent to a tariff of 350%, which is 1.5 times larger than what you find in developed countries. Trading among ourselves is even worse. The barriers equivalent to a 435% tariff. So unless we can deal with these costs and bringing them down, it will be very difficult for us to actualize a good implementation of the Continental Free Trade Area.
But with many countries just recovering from the negative effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, reducing tariffs comes with its own problems.
Some countries on the continent, they actually depend on these tariffs and customs duties as the bulk of their revenues. So it's going to be a real challenge. And that is why for least developed countries, for instance, the protocol, the agreement is that they have a longer period of time to implement because of the recognition that it is difficult. This is not going to happen overnight.
The agreement establishing the AFCFTA was signed in 2018. It is the world's largest free trade area, according to the bloc, bringing together the more than 50 countries of the African Union and 8 regional economic communities, such as ECOWAS and the East African Community. So, said the IMF chief, it might take some time to realize its full potential.
Gozi said, we are not talking about moving from today to tomorrow. We are talking about the process. We just have to have the ambition to pursue reduction of tariffs. And also, on the continent, there is still quite a lot that can be done to bring tax revenues up by improving tax collection and tapping into higher income in a more, in a fairer, more prudent way.
Last year, Kenya shipped its first batches of locally made car batteries and tea to Ghana. Njuguna Ndungu, the cabinet secretary at the Kenyan National Treasury, celebrated, but noted that the batteries took 8 weeks to be transported from Nairobi to Accra.
Why did it take 8 weeks? It's because purely of the infrastructure problems that we have. The connectivity is a problem. But let me say, because you have an opportunity to trade, you look for opportunities in terms of how you solve the problem in the first instance and how you make that solution sustainable. Right now, I wouldn't say taking 8 weeks is going to be sustainable, but it is worth a try.
In the meantime, he said, we are going to look into how to improve connectivity. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Hundreds of thousands of people lined the streets of London on Saturday to witness the coronation of Britain's King Charles III in a ceremony filled with remarkable tradition and colorful pageantry, and watched by millions around the world on television and the internet. VOA's Henry Ridgewell has more.
It's a moment 7 decades in the making. Charles became heir to the British throne at the age of just 3. Now 74, his coronation marks a new chapter for an ancient institution. King Charles III and Queen Consort Camilla were taken by carriage from Buckingham Palace to Westminster Abbey. Hundreds of thousands of people lined the route of the procession, just as they had done 8 months ago for the funeral of Charles's mother, Queen Elizabeth II. A small number of anti-monarchy protesters briefly drowned out the cheers. Inside the abbey, a congregation of more than 2,000 people, the royal family, kings and queens, presidents and prime ministers, and members of the public. Prince Harry, Charles's youngest son, attended alone amid continued strained relations. This was not a day for family drama, though, but for pomp and pageantry, deeply imbued with Christian faith. Some of the rituals remain unchanged over 1,000 years. Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, led the service.
The coronation oath has stood for centuries and is enshrined in law. Are you willing to take the oath?
The king gave his reply.
I am willing.
For the first time, female bishops took part in the service alongside leaders of other faiths. The Archbishop of Canterbury placed the crown upon Charles's head.
God save the king!
God save the king!
Gun salutes rang out across Britain. In a touching moment, Charles's son, Prince William, pledged his allegiance to the king.
I, William, Prince of Wales, pledge my loyalty to you, and faith and truth I will bear unto you, as your liege man of life and limb. So help me God.
Here in London and in cities, towns and villages across Britain, people gathered to watch this ancient and extraordinary ceremony. The rain may be falling, but people here are determined that spirits won't be dampened. Many felt they witnessed a part of history. Aurelien is a fan of the royal family who travelled from France.
Once in a life, you know, it's magical. I mean, it's such an incredible event.
The king and queen returned to Buckingham Palace in the gold state coach, built in 1762. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A new report by UNICEF says it will take about 300 years to totally eliminate the practice of child marriage. That's well after the target of 2030 set by the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. Still, some progress has been made. UNICEF says the percentage of women aged 20 to 24 who were married as children fell from 23% to 19% over the past 10 years. Nankali Maksud, UNICEF Senior Advisor on Child Protection, tells my colleague Carol Van Dam the number of child marriages is still the highest in South Asia, home of 45% of the world's child brides, but outgoing crises like armed conflict and climate change-related disasters are expected to increase the number of child marriages, especially in sub-Saharan Africa.
We know that in Africa today, and we can expect over the next few years, all the way through to 2030, 2050, is that because of the combination of increased population, because of conflict, because of climate change, and other crises that are taking place, sub-Saharan Africa is moving very fast to be the second, you know, continent that's going to be as highly affected or, you know, even more highly affected than South Asia.
What can communities do to try to counteract that? Some of these communities, they really follow their traditions and cultures. And in their culture, it's not unusual at all for girls to be married at young age.
So, yes, indeed, we've seen that the traditions, cultures, and beliefs play a strong part. And of course, patriarchy and gender equality is really very much at the core of what's driving child marriage. But increasingly, I also want to say that issues, you know, as we've picked up in the report, such as just plain old poverty, the decisions that families have to make in terms of how they're going to survive are playing a significant role in terms of driving child marriage. And so the cases that we have, the cases that we will continue to have in terms of child marriage are very much driven, you know, by poverty. In terms of addressing social norms, UNICEF is doing a lot of work with religious leaders, with traditional leaders, with and increasingly now with women's groups, feminist groups, who are really playing a key role in terms of, you know, challenging these beliefs, challenging these religions, these cultures, to be able to try and roll back those type of beliefs around child marriage, and also just put more value in girls, which has not been there from before, except in terms of seeing a girl's value around the monetary factor that she can be able to bring to a family.
Nankali Maksud is UNICEF Senior Advisor on Child Protection. She spoke to my colleague Carol Van Dam from Johannesburg, South Africa. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half, Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndumbulo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The eight teams for the 2023 Basketball Africa League playoff have been confirmed following the conclusion of the Nike Conference held in Cairo, Egypt. Cape Town Tigers secured the last spot for the playoffs after beating City Oilers of Uganda 80-70 on Saturday. The South African champions advanced to the playoffs for the second time in a row. Other Nike Conference teams heading to the next round include champions Petro de Luanda, Al Hakli of Egypt, and Ferroviário de Beira of Mozambique. In table tennis news, Egyptians Hana Gorda and Omar Assar are the 2023 ITTF Africa Cup women's and men's singles champions, following scintillating displays at the Moi International Sports Center Kasarani Indoor Sports Gymnasium in Nairobi, Kenya. In the men's category, Egyptians Omar Assar defeated Nigerian legend Arna Quadri 4-1 in the best-of-seven men's singles final. In winning the Nairobi edition of the Continental Cup, Assar chalked up his 10th career ITTF Africa title, having won the 2018 edition in Nairobi.
Always share training together, and it's almost there are no surprises in the game. We try to change a little bit there and here and there, but of course, like I said, he's a great player, great fighter, and he's also our African ambassador, and I respect him a lot.
In the women's category, Hana Gada staged a stunning comeback to defend the women's singles title with a convincing 4-3 victory over Olympian and multiple winner Dina Meshrev. And now to athletics, where Kenya is hoping to build on its successful hosting of the World Athletics Intercontinental Tour Series by beating for the Premier Diamond League meeting. Morocco's capital, Rabat, is currently the only African city to stage the Diamond League Track and Field Elite one-day series, which features 14 host cities on four continents. Athletics Kenya President Jackson Tui said the country had made an application to World Athletics for the upgrade of the second-tier Intercontinental Tour Series, whose fourth edition will be held in Nairobi on May 13th to become a Diamond League meet.
We would like to see that we get this one upgraded to Diamond League, and I think it is being considered. We hope next time when we meet, we'll be talking about Diamond League.
And finally, in football news, two matches were played on Saturday at the CAF Under-17 Africa Cup of Nations. Nigeria's Golden Eaglet staged a remarkable fight back to edge out South Africa 3-2 in Constantine to progress to the quarterfinals of the CAF Under-17 Africa Cup of Nations, currently holding in Algeria. In the other Group B match played at the Stade du 19 May 1956, Emmanuel Nwanza scored an
87th minute penalty as Zambia beat Group B leaders Morocco 2-1 in Annaba on Saturday, but it was not enough to see them through to the quarterfinals. And that's all for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. With great regret, the tried and tested practice of quiet diplomacy is increasingly being set aside in preference to the loud and public media diplomacy. Yet, the record will show that quiet diplomacy has produced durable, practical results in the settlement of disputes. Frankly, many governments in dispute would prefer quiet diplomacy because it assures confidentiality and also makes it possible for parties in dispute to give in and also take some in negotiations without concern that they will be criticized by hardliners in their own countries or in the side of their own disputes. This situation is, of course, not outside the realm of media diplomacy, but it is often the case that media diplomacy results in endless bargaining without much result. One can see also the situation in Sudan, where for the fourth year we are in ongoing fighting, pitting interest in becoming the chief broker of agreements. And these parties, the two opposing generals, seem to have become adept at manipulating this search to become the chief broker of settlements. If you look at what has happened, it's very strange. One power will triumph that they have agreed to get ceasefire, and the parties have agreed, and another will say they have been able to do it, but then there is no ceasefire. Yet, though there are no ceasefire, people still argue that they are the ones going to arrange a ceasefire. There are times when we hear from the media that the South Sudanese have agreed to host a conference in Juba involving the two parties. Other times we hear that talks are going to be held in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, either to deal with the quartet, which means Egypt, Saudi Arabia, England and UK, or a bilateral pressure from Saudi Arabia and the United States. Now we see a situation where, if you look at the Horn of Africa, where it's prone to disputes or crises, many nations are sending their own envoys without coordination, all with the aim of claiming that they made the peace. You could see also the quiet diplomacy could produce results. Recently, international community was so surprised to learn of the normalization of relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran in Beijing. But what was a surprise to the international community was a progress of quiet diplomacy that lasted weeks, if not months, with the assistance of some of the Gulf countries that resulted in the solution announced in Beijing. Then the question must be, where do we go? The United Nations, which have had many, many successes with the practice of quiet diplomacy over the decades, should be able to meet with Security Council members to urge that they try to coordinate whatever efforts they want for search for peace, and they should try to speak with one voice. This is a better procedure than this useless competition to make peace. Thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Nina. been so long, that I haven't seen your face. I'm trying to be strong, but the strength I have is washing away. It won't be long.
Baby, you the flow fine.
Fire, fire, dance. Yeah, you know.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peterson, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if a snake fails to show its venom, little kids will use it in tying firewood. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa. I need to go, I shadow.